Mr. Rowe.
Your Honors, good morning. May it please the Court. There are three issues I'd like to address this morning, the first two of which there seems to be no real disagreement between Davis and the state. The first is that mental impairment should serve as a ground to equitably toll the AEDPA statute of limitations period. Second, the standard by which such a claim is judged is whether that mental impairment in fact caused the untimely filing. And the third is that Davis satisfies the equitable tolling standard. Now, the first, and I'll be brief here because I believe that there's complete agreement with the state, is that mental impairment should serve as a grounds to equitably toll.
Well, the fact that an appellee concedes something doesn't make it so.
Certainly, Your Honor.
Perhaps you might want to address this issue. I'm interested in how this works as a matter of general federal law. Forget about the AEDPA for a second and ask what happens under the Federal Tort Claims Act or the two-year statute of limitations for Internal Revenue Service refunds. Is a mental disability a reason for tolling those statutes of limitations, the limitation under Title VII?
I believe that to be correct, Your Honor, and this court in Miller considered an equitable tolling argument under the Rehabilitation Act. And while
I know we've done that, has the Supreme Court ever said that a mental condition is a reason for tolling a federal statute of limitations?
Well, of course, certainly in the AEDPA context it has. Outside of that context, I'm afraid I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor.
I'm not sure I got your answer. Has the Supreme Court ever done this?
In the AEDPA context.
For general federal statutes of limitations, I don't see any reason why AEDPA would be treated differently from other statutes for this purpose. So I just want to figure out, we've got a more than 200-year history of federal statutes of limitations, right? I want to know what that history tells us about mental condition as a tolling doctrine. And then Congress enacts this 1996 law against that background. That's where I'm trying to go.
I'm afraid I don't know the answer to your question.
I've looked for Supreme Court cases on this, couldn't find any. Maybe there are none. It's a puzzle, you would think, because this is an issue that's been around for, well, as long as we've been a nation, you'd think.
I would assume that most folks who have Mr. Davis's mental capacity who are not in prison would have other people around
them
who might be able to help them.
Certainly, I agree with that, Your Honor.
And Mr. Davis is, in essence, telling us that at a critical point he was abandoned by his counsel in the original state prosecution and then was left without, he certainly had no access to counsel in prison.
Correct.
Except for the so-called jailhouse lawyers who are not lawyers.
Correct.
Okay. Let me ask you, if we agree with you, Mr. Rowe, can you help us draw some lines that would avoid, in essence, completely gutting time limits and leaving them only as equitable limits? I mean, here we've got a fellow who's in the lowest tenth of a percent measured by IQ with additional mental health problems as well. But if we agree with you, where might we draw some lines?
Certainly. Well, I certainly believe that the in fact causation analysis that courts generally engage in would help with that line drawing. There has to be, of course, some causal connection between the mental impairment.
That can't be enough, though. We have lots of people who file claims late and say, I just didn't realize this. Right? I'm a person of normal intelligence. I didn't get it that there had to be a timely filing. And the Supreme Court said that's no good. Judge Hamilton's question worries me, too, and I don't want to yank his question away from him, but how does one define the kind of mental limit that would matter so that when you say, believably, I don't get it, that's enough, given that when a normally able person says, I don't get it, that's not a reason for tolling?
I I think that's a fact-based question, Your Honor.
No. Legal rules are not fact-based questions. We confront the facts against some legal standard, right? Once we determine the facts, we compare them against a legal standard. Both Judge Hamilton and I are asking, what is the legal standard under which we're going to evaluate these facts?
I believe the legal standard is whether there's a causal connection between the two.
That cannot be sufficient for the reason I've just given.
But there's a difference between a mental impairment and someone, of course, simply claiming that
Why?
They didn't know.
Why couldn't a person with an IQ of 100 say, this federal law is just too complex for a person with an IQ of 100? Look at the tax code. Lawyers with IQs of 130 don't get it, right? I can't get it, so I don't have to comply with the statute of limitations. And somebody with an IQ of 100 who makes that claim loses. Now, I'm trying to figure out what is different, where one draws the line when somebody says, well, I've got an IQ of 50 or 75. We've got a bunch of cases, for example, saying that if somebody with an IQ of 50 can waive his rights under Miranda. Not clear why we would have a difference between who can waive his rights under Miranda and who needs to file a timely claim under the AEDPA. Maybe there is some legal line that can be drawn, but it would be nice to have some help.
I believe the in-fact standard is enough, Your Honor. And there are
that's not quite enough, I tend to agree. But you've got extraordinary circumstances, right? So help us define extraordinary circumstances.
I can't put an IQ number on what constitutes an extraordinary circumstance and what doesn't. But in context, you have things like IQ. You have documented mental illnesses. You have the ability for someone, whether they can read or write. You have a psychologist's analysis that says this person isn't competent to help in their legal proceedings. Those are the types of things that suggest to us that somebody isn't competent to file to make a timely filing. And
That finding of incompetence was just a few months after the conviction, correct?
Correct, in 2007. Yeah. And Judge Easterbrook, back to your question, I think there's just inherent differences between somebody who says that somebody with an IQ of 100 that says, I'm not smart enough to figure out the tax code, and somebody with an IQ of 50 who is completely disadvantaged at trying to figure out not just the tax code, but how to put their name on a piece of paper. That seems to me to be the difference.
One of the problems we've got here is we really don't have much of a factual record at all, given the way this was handled in the district court. How did he go about trying to get help from the law school clinic and a lawyer or two?
There is some evidence in the record where you'll see somebody signing Mr. Davis's name on his behalf. And so it'll say something like prepared by a jailhouse attorney, John Doe. Mm-hmm. And so from the record before us, that appears to be how he's communicated with potential attorneys and finally before
the court. How did Davis get convicted?
There
must have been a finding that he was competent to stand trial, which meant that he was competent, he had enough mental capacity to understand what was going on around him and assist his lawyer. If he had that amount of mental capacity, why does he have too little mental capacity to bring a collateral attack?
That type of the state court's inquiry into his mental health isn't in the record, so I can't speak to what.
Maybe that has some potential to be the standard, but of course, then it would be extraordinarily difficult for somebody to say, "I was competent at the time of trial. I had enough mental capacity to understand the proceedings and help my lawyer. Otherwise, I couldn't have been convicted. But sometime after my conviction, I've lost that. I slipped below that line." Maybe that's what a judge should be looking for.
Certainly that would be a brighter line than perhaps what I've suggested. But I still believe that all of this needs to be taken into account in making this determination. I see I'm running into rebuttal if I could reserve the rest of my time. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rowe. Mr. Weinstein.
May it please the Court. It's our position that the other circuits that have recognized equitable tolling in the context of the AEDPA, and this Court have recognized in other contexts other than AEDPA, would indicate that mental impairment can be an extraordinary circumstance. I was unable to find any Supreme Court law on it either, but there is law both in this circuit and in other circuits application of mental impairment for equitably tolling statute of limitations other than the AEDPA. The cases seem to indicate that it is the ability to communicate with counsel or assistance in the prison which would satisfy the type of, in fact, prevention to file that seems to, that this Court has used in other contexts and that seems to be the language of Holland. Mr. Davis was found competent in state court. He presented a number of...
Was there any real significant proceeding, or was that just a guilty plea colloquy?
My recollection is it was during the trial proceeding.
No, he pled guilty, right? And agreed to testify against other people. The underlying claim here is that he made a deal without his lawyer helping him. Right,
that's right. Okay.
So was there any kind of psychological evaluation of his competence at the time of the guilty plea? Or do we know?
It was probably, as I recall, it was before that. There was a competency proceeding sometime after his initial appearance on the information and the plea. It was not repeated on appeal, which we sometimes see. I noted that the psychological evaluation that he submitted to the district court with his opposition to the motion to dismiss was during the appeal. So if he had had trouble communicating with his appellate counsel, the counsel could have initiated competency proceedings during the appeal, but didn't.
Are you saying the appellate counsel got this evaluation saying this guy is not competent and submitted a no merits brief?
I don't think that appellate counsel did have the evaluation.
No.
What I'm saying is that I don't think the appellate counsel saw anything in communicating with him that would indicate a need to request a psychological evaluation as part of the state court proceeding.
Could I back up to the guilty plea?
I'm sorry?
The plea, when he pleaded guilty.
Yes.
Before that, I guess his attorney had set up an appointment and then didn't show up. Is that correct?
We didn't get that far in the district court.
The only reason I'm even bringing it up is because I assume that when he's pleading, he's got an attorney with him.
Yes.
And I'm making an assumption, and that whatever was agreed to without his attorney before was at least affirmed or something when he had counsel. Is that?
He had a counsel plea, yes.
Okay, and so the judge is aware of that. I mean, that's what I'm trying to get by that issue. I know it melted when we don't know what they agreed to and that he didn't know what they were talking about, etc., because his attorney didn't show up. But then later on, he pleads and the judge accepts the plea. I assume goes through the whole deal and the attorney is aware of that and has advised his client. But I just want to make sure that happened.
Yes, and it was a no merit appeal. So the Wisconsin Court of Appeals reviewed the entire record.
That's the next step.
And one of the issues that they did address. I'm sorry.
I just wanted to focus on what happened when he pleaded.
They reviewed the plea colloquy and assured themselves that there was no question of the voluntariness of the plea, and it was counseled, and all of the things that they normally look for in a plea for a no merit appeal. So, the other thing that's really up in the air about equitable tolling in the AEDPA context is exactly how you do it. What I did was the same way we do for statutory tolling, which is to count the days and subtract those that may be tolled. If you do that, and if you toll the 151 days between the first contact with the Remington Center and the date that Benbow Cheeseman gave that he was going to meet with Mr. Davis in the prison, he still comes up about 446 days of untold time. Counsel, it's also interesting that although he now claims that he was unable to file his federal petition, he was able to contact the Remington Center. He was able to discuss this matter with Mr. Cheeseman. He was able to get help in the prison to file the state collateral attack. So he was able to proceed, at least in the state court.
Counsel, here's what concerns me. You've got another 5 minutes. You've argued here that we should affirm because the plaintiff failed to prove in the district court that his mental retardation and mental illness caused his failure to file on a timely basis.
Right.
And I guess part of my problem here is how somebody who is as profoundly limited as Mr. Davis is could be expected even to recognize a need to prove that, let alone to go about doing so on a pro se basis.
Well, he did raise it on a pro se basis. He raised it in response to my motion to dismiss. Perhaps the district courts should appoint counsel.
Well, frankly, that's what I'm. Well, we have appointed counsel.
Right, I understand
and,
that, but in terms of,
look, I'm not ready to jump to a conclusion that equitable tolling certainly should apply here. But I'm troubled by doing this by trying to decide this without a hearing that would look into the circumstances. There's kind of a catch-22, it seems to me, buried in the state's reasoning here, which is, in essence, if you can prove what you need to prove to show equitable tolling, then you're capable enough that you don't need equitable tolling, right?
I suppose that could be viewed that way, yes.
And I don't think that's the way we ought to go with this.
I would think that would not work. Yes, but
I think somebody counsel is a good start.
Perhaps, unfortunately, the district court had no guidance at all from this circuit, and mm-hmm. not a lot from the others either. Yeah. But perhaps when Mr. Davis raised his mental impairments in the district court, that would have been the time for the appointment of counsel. I think that probably would have at least gotten us to the point where we would have an evidentiary record. But what the court did was look at what he presented and his allegation, which really went to his lack of education more than his mental impairment. And determined that
he missed the point, but that's only evidence of the problem.
Yes,
so.
I understand that, but that's what the district court did, and said, well, you didn't show that this actually prevented you from filing your federal claim, your federal petition in a timely manner. I think we'd all benefit from a better record, but we have what we have.
Is Mr. Davis getting close to release on this charge?
I did not calculate that out.
It was a 10-year, 9-year sentence, right? imposed back in 2000. He must have been in custody since about 2006.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Rowe?
I'll just address a few of the things that came up in opposing counsel's, and I'll start with Mr. Davis is close to being released. He's told me it's September 3rd, so he's only got about
could you
months.
Repeat, please?
September 3rd is Mr. Davis's supposed release date. Mm-hmm. He still is subject to some supervised release.
Quite a long time.
Correct. A couple other points I just want to make quickly is that much of what counsel has said about the plea colloquy, that's not in the record. And I think the broader point is that this type of case may be best left for an evidentiary hearing before the district court to determine to Judge Mannion's point about what might have happened during the plea colloquy, but more importantly, how Mr. Davis not only his IQ, how he was able to communicate with attorneys, things of that nature. And I agree with opposing counsel that a better record might be appropriate in this case.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Rowe, we appreciate your willingness and that.